You're with SBS Radio. Find more great stories in your language at sbs.com.au.
Twada Samaj, Twada Samvad, SBS Punjabi.
Dear SBS Punjabi listeners, today we are going to have a chat with Ms. Michelle Rowlin, who is very well known in our Indian, especially Punjabi community. She is a federal member of Greenway NSW, the area where most of the Indian subcontinent people are living. And Ms. Rowland is also Shadow Minister of Communications. Previously, she held a portfolio of Shadow Minister of Multiculturalism and Citizenship as well. So today we will talk about both her present and her previous roles. First of all, welcome to SBS Punjabi, Ms. Rowlin.
Thank you very much. Sat Sri Akal.
Sat Sri Akal ji. That's so nice of you. Ms. Rowlin, as you are aware that communication travels on media, especially it travels much, much faster on electronic and social media these days. So what do you think should be the limitations, boundaries and kind of framework from Australian government's context? I mean, how it's working and what needs to be done?
Well, it's a really interesting question with a lot of parts in it. I think all of your listeners will be very aware that the Australian media environment comprises commercial media, also public broadcasters such as our good friends at the SBS.
Mm-hmm.
But now more than ever, people are turning to digital sources for their news and information as well. And it is a conundrum that many governments find themselves in and many regulators, because the mm-hmm. rules that apply to the what we call traditional or legacy media don't always apply to online platforms like Google and Facebook.
Mm.
And it's a great challenge, not only just for regulation and for the rules around it, but also for journalists like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a situation where public interest journalism is really challenged in Australia. There are some parts of Australia that don't have any specific media other than, say, one or two radio outlets at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And even in areas like Western Sydney and Northwest Sydney, we've had local papers close.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have many more people able to access data online, but the real challenge is to make sure that this is localised, that people are getting news that they want, and that people can discern between what is good journalism and appreciate that journalism, as opposed to what's been commonly termed as fake news.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an enormous challenge. But I think one of the key things is that we should support public interest journalism.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be more of an emphasis also, I believe, on media literacy to enable people to understand how to obtain news and how to question
mm-hmm.
News as well. There is a tendency, I'm sure many of your listeners would be aware, that if you go on a search engine like Google and you look up particular news, there's really no way of being able to disseminate in a lot of cases whether that news is real or not.
Hmm. What is the government's framework kind of, you know, how the government is helping? I will just rephrase this question. Most recently, there was New Zealand massacre in the mosque, and rather than asking Facebook and YouTube to put more controls, so what governments should be doing?
Well, I think governments should do two things. The first is we need to really look at the causes
mm-hmm.
Of why we have individuals who are obviously very disturbed but also very motivated by racism and hate in mm-hmm. a lot of cases. We need to be attacking that at the source. We need to ensure that the platforms have the responsibility not to encourage this sort of behaviour. I mean, even after that terrible Christchurch massacre took place, it was still possible to access that footage
mm-hmm.
on different platforms. Now, those platforms need to be held to account. There needs to be rules in place. And, you know, with the support of Labor, the government has taken some steps in that direction, which is a good thing. But we need to really attack the root causes of hate speech. Hate speech really is the motivating it's the motivation behind a lot of these instances in the first place. But the second is also, this is a global, these are global platforms, so it's a global problem. I don't think it's sufficient for any government to think that we should be going it alone. I think certainly there are particular laws that we've put in place in Australia, which is a good thing. But these platforms, you can access them from anywhere in the world. And I think it's incumbent not only on the Australian government, but on all governments to make sure that we've got a global approach to this this issue. And it might sound enormous and incapable of being achieved, but much has been achieved in the intellectual property space, so in copyright, on a global level. We had enormous problems as we moved into the digital age with piracy of film and content and other other brands, and we managed to deal with that on a global level. So I think it's incumbent on the Australian government and all governments to work together. You know, it's pleasing to see that there are have been some positive steps in this direction, but you know, we don't know in what direction technology is going to move. All we know is that it will go forward.
Because communication relies heavily on mode of travel.
That's right.
Kind of, you know, broadband or NBN and stuff. I was reading a report sometime back, it was in August 2019, that Australia ranks last out of 36 OECD countries on entry-level broadband affordability. Why?
Well, it's a great concern. And Australia has for some time, unfortunately, even before the privatisation of Telstra, way back now, we've had a serious problem with infrastructure. It simply has not kept pace with the needs of Australian consumers, which was one of the reasons that led to Kevin Rudd announcing that we would build a national broadband network so that we, regardless of where you lived in Australia, you were able to access high-quality, affordable broadband. Now, unfortunately, the Parliamentary Library's done this analysis of data from Point Topic. It's a UK-based market analytics firm. And you know, I think one of the biggest issues is that we need better outcomes for low-income consumers. Like it is a problem indeed, as you point out, that Australia's international rankings are very challenged. But we are more and more living in an age where even to interact with governments, you're expected to be online. Our children are expected to be able to sit for a number of educational tests online.
And even the census, you know, when the census was done, I mean, the bandwidth wasn't enough. It just froze, kind of.
Oh, yes.
So what you think, like, has to be done immediately to fix this problem?
Well, the complex, you know, the problems are, you know, very complex. You know, it's, I'm encouraged to see that entry-level pricing is now getting more of a focus from the industry and also from the regulators, including the competition regulator. But it is an important social and equity objective, and it's not going to be solved immediately. I mean, the fact that we rank last out of OECD nations for entry-level affordability really highlights that we need to give better attention to this, and we need to lift our game on digital inclusion. This, you know, often digital inclusion is discussed in the context of metropolitan areas and regional areas, but it's also cohorts who are younger and older who are missing out, and people on different incomes, but also people with a disability and people from ethnically diverse backgrounds. So it's a problem for all of the economy when you have such important cohorts missing out on participation. You can understand why people become so frustrated that, you know, not only are they getting, they're not getting a service that they paid for, but it's such, there is such a digital divide between Australians who have, who are lucky enough to have fibre to the home, and then other Australians who are relying on second-rate copper. And again, this is a whole issue of equity that is being ignored by this government.
We will just touch base on another thing that Australian Federal Police had raided News Corp and ABC journalists' offices some time back. What are your comments as Shadow Communication Minister?
Well, it's very concerning to see these raids having taken place, and it was more than one raid, and it has happened in the not-so-distant past as well. And it's quite clear that these raids were intended to intimidate journalists as well as whistleblowers. And I think it's very important to recognise that it is actually, we want people to do the right thing, and we rely on people to call out bad behaviour, and people will do this if they can have some assurances that they'll be protected. It is very hard to be a whistleblower today because everyone leaves a digital footprint in one way or another. The only way to minimise the amount of footprint you have is really to send information through the mail, through the post. So I think it was important, and Labor thought it was very important, to have the Parliament given some wide-ranging powers to examine media freedom. It's unfortunate that the government voted down Labor's proposal, and that matter has been referred to the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence and Security. And it's going to focus on the balance between media freedom and national security legislation, and the lines of that have really been blurred in recent years. But I think it's important to note that this inquiry won't consider the issue of whistleblowers, even though the raids will have a really serious chilling effect on whistleblowers in Australia. And I'm particularly concerned by the fact that journalists should be allowed to do their jobs. Australia has been at the forefront of arguing for freedom of journalists overseas. We had the very publicised case of Peter Greste a couple of years ago, and yet on our home soil, we're raiding not only commercial entities, but also our public broadcaster, the ABC. So it's extremely concerning to see that this has taken place.
Thank you so much for your views. And now we are going back to, say, 2016, when you were Shadow Minister of Multiculturalism and Citizenship. From your experience, can you please comment on the current citizenship levels that are all-time low now? Waiting lists are so long, and Indians, among others, are hugely impacted by this.
Certainly, and I've seen the frustration in local residents who want to become Australian citizens, who've completed all the documentation and are sitting around waiting for their citizenship ceremonies or their paperwork to be processed. I cannot fathom why Australia isn't opening its arms to more people who make a conscious choice to become Australian citizens. We've never had such a low, what we like to call, pathway to permanency. I think it should be the aim of all Australian governments to have as many people seeking to be permanent Australians, so in other words, gain citizenship. And I think that the fact that someone has made a choice to be an Australian demonstrates that it must be an enormous decision. I'm an Australian by birth, and it never ceases to amaze me that people who are very ready to pledge their loyalty to Australia to become citizens, and I'm yet to meet the person who says, oh, I wish I hadn't become an Australian citizen. Every person I've met who's chosen Australian citizenship has worked hard, has followed their aspirations, and has wanted a better life for themselves and their families. They're exactly the kind of Australians we should be encouraging. So I find it perverse that we're in 2019 and our levels of citizenship are so low. I put this down to, in many ways, bureaucratic issues, but they're certainly not beyond the control of government. And I believe that there should be an enhanced focus on ensuring that people who want to be Australians can become Australians as soon as possible.
You mentioned about path to permanency, and one of them is like student visas. Most of the Indian students come here for study, and then they try to, you know, continue here, living here. And recently, Indian students' visa category was shifted to high-risk category now. Assessment levels have been changed. Do you think it will impact the faith and sentiment and the industry as well?
I'm concerned that it will. And you know, I'm sure the department will say, and it's something that we can explore in the Parliament, and I know a number of my colleagues who represent high subcontinent constituencies feel the same. This is something we need to explore through the Senate estimates process that's coming up. The reasons given for this change in category appear quite vague to me. I can't recall a time when we had concern, such a high level of concern about the levels of students coming from the subcontinent. We should be actually encouraging them, if for no other reason that education as an export market is very important to Australia. We want to see overseas students who want to come here, study, and God willing, take a path to permanency and utilise their skills in Australia and contribute to the economy.
Now, regarding your connections with the Indian subcontinent community, especially the Punjabi community, what type of common issues are raised by the community in your constituency?
Well, interestingly, I think most of them go back to you know, just the day-to-day, what I like to call logistics of life. So be it in their local areas, it's having adequate facilities for them and their children. It's ensuring that there is adequate infrastructure in our local areas. But also on a bigger scale, a lot of people from the subcontinent I've been contacted by are very concerned about broadband and technology generally, and not only broadband, but also even access to, in some, particularly in some of our newer suburbs, access to pretty basic mobile services. There's a lot of, again, we talk about black spots in regional areas, but even in some of the new suburbs that I represent, people find it very difficult to get a reliable mobile signal in their own home. One of the jobs I can I can help with is raising these with the telecommunications carriers, because certainly it's in their interest to have the highest quality services available to people, because that means people will be more ready to use their services. People are very smart, far smarter than I think a lot of politicians give them credit for. They can see that interest rates are at an all-time low, which is good if you've got a mortgage, because it means you can pay it off quicker. But at the same time, I think people are feeling the stress of job uncertainty. A lot of families whom I talk to, they have parents who are working two or three different jobs. And again, that's of great concern in an uncertain economic times. I'm often getting asked my opinion about how I think the trade wars are going on and how that will impact on Australia. And there's one thing I know for certain, trade wars only have losers. They don't have winners. We live in a globalised economy these days. Australia can't shut itself off from the rest of the world. But it's very difficult to tell at the moment what the impact will be. I think we're really entering a period of volatility in the global economy. And I think that's weighing on the minds of a lot of people. It's why a lot of people aren't spending money at the moment either. They're very concerned about what the future holds.
Sure. And as you're already aware, that founder of Sikhism, Guru Nanak Dev Ji's 550th birth anniversary is coming up next month. Would you like to give any message to Punjabi community, especially the Sikh community?
I would like to say it is a great honour to be paying my respects on the birthday of Guru Nanak, which will be on the 29th of November. He was born on the 29th of November 1469, which makes this a very significant birthday. And I think Guru Nanak not only is remembered for the founder of Sikhism, but in particular I think some of his teachings are not only universal but have transcended the ages. For example, the teachings about women, that women and men should have equality, and he noted that women were the mother of princes and kings, which was certainly ahead of its time in many ways, but also the rejection of the caste system, and noting that everyone, by taking the same surname, demonstrated that they were of the one humanity. So the teachings of Sikhism are indeed eternal, and they are very much Australian values. And I would like to wish everyone who is celebrating this very momentous occasion all the best and every happiness.
Thank you so much. And thanks for your time talking to us about other matters as well.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
ਤੁਹਾਡਾ ਸਮਾਜ ਤੁਹਾਡਾ ਸੰਵਾਦ SBS ਪੰਜਾਬੀ
Tell us what you think. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter.